Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of History Hack. I've been left on my own again. I'm starting to think it might be my deodorant or something. But I am joined today by another human being. I am joined by Peter James Bowman, who is a translator and historian, who has written many periodical articles and books. His other titles including Fortune Hunter, A German Prince in Regency England, and The Real Persuasion. And he's here to talk to us about his newest book, First Celebrities, Five Regency Portraits. So, Peter, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Let's dive straight in. Celebrity culture in the 21st century is all too common. We've got, they're everywhere. You can't pick up a newspaper, turn on the news, open up the internet, even Twitter, with the latest celebrity news. But how would you define celebrity culture, and when did it first start to appear?
Well, I think the key thing about celebrity culture is that nobody's in charge. You've got three elements to it. You've got the celebrity individual, who's motivated by love of attention, desire to make money, the wish to put across certain opinions and so forth. You've got the celebrity industry, which is a huge range of people from managers, agents, handlers of various sorts, to journalists, photographers, hairdressers, all sorts of people who have a vested interest in the celebrity and in making the celebrity popular and remunerative. And then you've got the audience, the fans and other people who are interested in celebrities. And they have a role in shaping the celebrity as well, because they have expectations and needs from the celebrity. And they make the celebrity act up to a certain sort of image. So you get this slight separation between the real person and the public image. And that image is generated in part by the desires of the audience. And the odd thing about it is that all three of those elements are probably of equal importance. So there's a phenomenon going on that nobody's in control of.
Oh, absolutely. And every now and then, like you said, you have like a public image and the private image. And every now and then you get the public image flips and the private image can come through, and it's they can be quite different.
They can be, and then the audience or the fans react to that, and they decide whether they want to forgive this slip up, whatever it was, or they want to punish the celebrity. So the audience has a degree of power over the celebrity by being able to judge whether the celebrity has behaved in a good way or in a bad way. And from the side of the celebrity and the celebrity industry, they have to feed information to the audience about the celebrity, which has to be basically true about that person, but it isn't the whole truth. It's a sort of simplified version. And that creates all these tensions, which can lead to unexpected things happening.
I'm not going to name the current American rapper and what he's been saying, but how did this start to appear in sort of the Georgian period?
Well, there are various ideas about when celebrity culture started, when it became recognisably what it is now. Some people say the start of film, some people say the start of television. But there's a sort of consensus that it started in the late 18th century, and mainly in London. And it's a whole range of things, really. It's things like the growth of a capitalist economy, migration from the countryside to towns, and the opportunities that were opened up to people who are outside of the higher classes of society. People started making a name for themselves and having opportunities. Education and literacy improved as well. Made all sorts of people able to gain prominence, you know, for very worthy reasons, but also for more frivolous reasons as well. And then there was a free press as well, with a lot of personal information, a lot of gossip, the growth of images, paintings, engravings, the popularity of portraiture. It's the great age of caricatures as well, satirical prints. And all these things together, together with an awareness on the side of the celebrities that they had to court public opinion and put out a certain image, led to something which, although it's much simpler and much less immediate than modern celebrity culture, nevertheless has the same basic working parts. And so it can be described as the birth of celebrity.
Before we get on to portraiture and caricatures, I wanted to start with poets, Byron and Shelley. How were they made celebrities by their writings?
Well, at this sort of time, or throughout the 18th century, really, there was a move away from the patronage style of literature where writers didn't have to make money. They were either given state jobs or they had patrons to look after them, and publishing was on a very small scale, to a situation by the end of the 18th century where publishing was completely commercial, as it largely is now. And so authors had to write for a living. And in doing so, it was in their interest to develop a sort of public persona. People became interested in who the person was holding the pen. And they started putting themselves about more. They gave lectures, they appeared in literary salons. A lot of criticism in reviews was very biographical. This is the great age of periodical reviews, the late 18th and early 19th centuries. A lot of people started publishing memoirs about themselves and each other. And people became literary lions. You know, they were sought after. People would even try and find them out in their homes and sort of peer at them. So the writer as personality became established. And Lord Byron, I think, whom you've just mentioned, was the most striking example of that.
Absolutely. His name still resonates today.
Yeah.
They are Byron and Shelley, although if you say Shelley, most people think of Mary Shelley. But he's still very much in print and read now these days.
Yes, and what Byron did, which took celebrity to another level, is that he modelled his heroes on himself, the heroes of his poems, and then he started modelling himself on his heroes. So Byronic characters and Lord Byron himself became, a little bit interchangeable, and people started reading the poems to find out about him. They became fascinated by him as a man, and they read his books to try and find out hints about his life, and especially about his private life. And then the publisher, John Murray, realised what a good formula this was, so he encouraged him to write more poems with the same sorts of heroes. Byron realised he was onto a good thing and started actually acting up a Byronic image, which didn't actually always suit him and wasn't really all that much like him in some ways. But he encouraged rumours and tried to lead this sort of dissipated lifestyle and put out an image of being bored and cynical about everything. So he became the ultimate celebrity writer.
At the moment, we have quite a huge celebrity culture around actors. In the Regency period as well, this also sort of took off with poets and actors becoming more and more famous as well, didn't it?
It did, yeah. I mean, actors in some ways are natural celebrities because they're used to performing in front of an audience for a living. So the performative aspect of being a celebrity, you know, acting a certain way in public and living up to your image, is something that they're already doing as part of their job. The other aspect with the theatre is it's hard to overestimate how important the theatre was then. I mean, a lot of forms of public entertainment that exist now didn't exist then, and everybody went to the theatre. All classes of people went to the theatre. There were loads of strolling companies of strolling players that went to tiny towns and even villages and performed in barns and above pubs and things. And the London theatres were the centre of fashionable and cultural life. So people wanted to know who these actors were, especially the most successful ones. And because actors tended to play parts that suited them and somehow matched their personality, whether it was sort of flirtatious chambermaids or grumpy old men or whatever, people wanted to know if that's what the person really was like. And so again, you get this connection between the literature and the reality, you know, between the person that they were portraying on the stage and the real person. And people were very curious about actors, and there was a huge amount about them in the press, and there were an awful lot of images of them bought and sold.
So there's not that much of a change from then to now in certain respects. There is a over fascination with, in my opinion, of Hollywood actors. And But also in a society where women are mainly overlooked, what made Harriet, Duchess of St. Albans' life stand out?
Well, I suppose the origin of it was the two marriages that she made. She was an actress, a sort of second tier actress, and she married a very successful banker, that Thomas Coutts, the founder of the Coutts banking dynasty, so the an enormously wealthy and prominent person. And he was 79 when they got married, and she was, I think, 37. So, but they, you know, they seemed to have a genuinely loving marriage, but he was so adoring, and devoted to her that, when he died, he didn't just leave her all his money, but he actually left her a controlling stake in Coutts Bank in the Strand. So she was by far the wealthiest woman in Britain, and she was completely independent. She had partners who ran the bank on a day-to-day basis, but she played a part in it. And she was so wealthy that she was presented with the question of what she should do with all this money. And what she did was become a sort of innovative party giver. She gave the best parties or the most extravagant parties. And she also made sure that she was in the papers all the time. She leaked information about what she was doing, and the newspapers were always reporting where she was going, who she was meeting, what charities she'd given, and so on. So she basically liked being in the public eye all the time. And some people were interested in her, some people resented this. And then she married a duke who was obviously interested in her money. He was 20 years younger than her, and that caused a big stir as well. And everywhere you looked, you found information about this woman. And the other thing about her is she tried to wheedle her way into the top ranks of society, but she wasn't really accepted because of her origin. She was from a very, very simple background. She was the daughter of a wardrobe keeper in a company of strolling actors. So she was from a very poor background, and she was never really accepted in society, but she kept on trying by means of charitable giving and these parties that she had, and constantly paying for her name to be in the papers to break into society. And that created a sort of public spectacle. Would she succeed or wouldn't she?
Despite her being her best publicist, would you say that the social class system was strong enough then to... I don't think strong enough is the right word, but I don't think about how to put this in English, that the class structure was so inwardly facing that it still wasn't allowing people in.
No, that was part of it. Yes, there was the fact that it was still fairly closed. I mean, there were ways in for people, but yes, of course, they despised her for her origins. But the other thing was that she tried to do it on her own terms. Instead of completely fawning on, you know, the marchionesses and the duchesses and so on, she tried to carry on being herself, and she would speak honestly about her origins, and she would have a certain sort of direct way about her, which people described as vulgarity, and she refused to change that. She liked to telling stories about her past as a young actress, rising actress. She liked to have a joke. She liked to banter with people, and she didn't want to change that, so she tried to sort of force her way through on her own terms, and they weren't having it,
rather than playing the game, as it were.
Yes.
Another prominent woman that you talked about was Princess Dorothea Lievin. She goes on to play quite an important role in Anglo-Russian diplomacy. But how well known was her role?
Well, initially, she came to this country in 1812 as the wife of the Russian ambassador, and it became apparent very quickly that she was the real ambassador, because her husband was a bit of a non-entity and she was much more intelligent than him. But in her first years in Britain, she was known as a leader of society. She wasn't known for political or diplomatic activity. She was known as a leader of society. She was extremely dignified, and I suppose she had a sort of exotic aspect to her because she was Russian, and there were very few foreigners in Britain at the time because of the Napoleonic Wars. She dressed beautifully. She was very clever and witty. People were slightly in awe of her. They didn't necessarily like her, but they were slightly fearful of her because she had a sharp tongue. And so she was a social leader, really. And she was a patroness of the Almack Balls, which were the most fashionable balls that were held once a week in central London, in Mayfair. And She obviously gave parties as the ambassadress, which was what they called the wife of an ambassador then. And she mixed in diplomatic circles. So she was known as a high society figure. It was only later, when she discovered her love of politics and meddling and being a channel of information, that people started to realize that she had more and more of a political position, and that was much more problematic, and people reacted much more negatively to that. But that wasn't the case until about 10 years or so after she arrived.
What kind of things was she getting involved in?
Well, she became a sort of unofficial channel of information between governments. And she became, for the Russians, she became a way of eliciting information, secret information about British political life and diplomatic activity. She had a very captivating manner, and she was very responsive to the talk of political men. Powerful men lived in a completely male world. And women were discouraged from even talking about politics because they would be accused of being blue stockings or encroaching on a man's terrain. So men lived in a completely male world in politics. It was quite a sort of fusty, boring world, really, quite colourless. And so when they encountered a woman who listened to them and understood them and praised them and was bright-eyed and gave interesting responses, they were completely bowled over by her. They'd never had this before. And they told her things that they shouldn't have told her. And she sent all the information back to St. Petersburg. And then she started having an affair with Metternich, the Austrian chancellor. And Austria and Russia were very close because they were the two conservative powers. And she started sending information to him as well. And some British political figures who were also very conservative and wanted to ally Britain with those countries and move away from more liberal countries, they started using her as a conduit as well. So she was somebody who was taking a position on the British political scene too. And she developed this massive network of contacts.
Oh, wow. So she was really quite active.
Oh yes, she was very active. And then of course, as time went by, the general public and the press started realizing what was happening. They saw how much power she was wielding and how she'd broken the rules in the sense of women not being allowed to have anything to do with politics. And there was quite a lot of resentment about her as a foreigner having all this influence over men. I mean, people like Lord Grey, mm-hmm. the Duke of Wellington, they were always in her company and always telling her things that they shouldn't have been telling. And she tried to interfere by having her friends promoted in government. She tried to influence foreign policy. She became part of a sort of coterie around the king, George IV, who wanted to promote a certain line and was in opposition to the fairly liberal Prime Minister George Canning for a while in the 1820s. And when this became apparent, the reaction was really furious. That this woman was interfering. She even tried to interfere in internal British politics, domestic politics. She was an opponent of the Reform Bill, or she was accused of being one. So that's when things started getting sticky for her, when people realised that she was playing an unofficial political role. She was what they called a petticoat politician. That was the term of abuse that was used.
What happened to her in the end?
In the end, it's a sort of story of addiction in a way, because She became so obsessed with politics, so addicted to it, that she was always intriguing for its own sake by the end. And she became too arrogant, too pushy, and too nosy as well. And she started losing her touch, the old charm that she'd had, and the way that she'd had of playing men like a fiddle. That started to desert her, and she started getting a little bit too forceful. And she was also a little bit triumphalist when things went right for her and went right for Russia. And in the end, she fell out with the Foreign Secretary, Lord Palmerston, and he engineered a very clever way of getting rid of her by appointing somebody as ambassador to Russia that the Tsar couldn't accept. So the Tsar said, I can't accept this person, please find somebody else. And Palmerston refused. And because Britain then had no ambassador in Russia, Russia, to maintain equivalence, had to withdraw its ambassador, which is Princess Lieven's non-entity husband, from London. And that way she was expelled. Wow, so she just went too far and offended too many people.
That's the Squire genius move.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I have to be careful with it. I'm going to trip over this because this is quite a mouthful of a name. Who was Richard Temple Bridges Chandos Grenville, and why was he? Does he become a favourite of the caricaturists?
Well, in terms of his family background, he's basically the product of generations of very, very clever marriages, bringing estates together. And the estate he owned, which was centred on Stowe House in Buckinghamshire, which is a school now, was really enormous. I mean, he had a vast income, and he also owned about 11 MPs. In other words, he chose them, you know, in constituencies with very small electorates where he was the landlord. He basically told people how to vote, and they voted for his placeman. And he had this faction in Parliament that were called the Grenvilleites, Grenville being the family name, and he manoeuvred them about and offered the two larger parties, the Whigs and the Tories, an alliance with his little group, and became a sort of power broker. This is all in the pre-reform Parliament, after 1832 and the Reform Act, that this kind of thing wouldn't have been possible anymore. But when he was active, he used his faction, and he did it in a very cynical and selfish way that earned him a lot of criticism. And at the same time, he tried to play the great grandee. He tried to be like a feudal overlord in Buckinghamshire, where he was the great man of the county and had these 4 or 5 day long parties with archery competitions and oxen and pigs roasted whole, and going like a sort of medieval pageant he had. Mm. And this sort of set him up as somebody that people would want to dislike. And when lots and lots of things went wrong for him, he had all sorts of mishaps in his personal life, and he made a fool of himself in lots of ways, and he was also enormously fat. He became a sort of gift for caricaturists and also writers who wanted to include him in works of fiction, and people sort of wanted to see him fall, and he often did. He made so many mistakes. He was a little bit insensitive towards other people, and In his private life, he made a fool of himself with women. He even insulted one woman who wouldn't have an affair with him, and tried to blacken her name. And then somebody challenged him to a duel. His son wanted to marry a famous courtesan. He fell out with the Royal Yacht Squadron, but carried on flying their pennant and was made a fool of for that. All sorts of things he did wrong. And when he had a government position, and it ended, he took home all the stationery, all the pen and paper, and sealing wax, and that provided an endless subject of jokes and of satirical prints. There's one of him as called The Fall of Icarus, where he's flying too close to the sun and his wings fall apart, and the wings are made of feathers for writing with, and they're attached with sealing wax, and the wax melts, and he falls to the ground. And so he was an absolute gift. He was a sort of larger than life buffoon.
Were these publications like Punch magazine?
That's a bit later. But the period that he was living in, and the period that I've written this book about, is the golden age of the satirical prints. People like Cruikshank and Heath and so on, Gilray, and these. These prints were available for sale in shops, either as single items or together. And they were very popular. They were endlessly reproduced, sometimes hand-coloured. And people would sort of stare in at the windows of these shops that were selling them. And people knew all these prints. And there was a huge readership of newspapers as well, where there were endless puns about him. I mean, they didn't seem very funny to us, but there were constant punning. There was constant punning about him. One that I can remember is he had an affair with a daughter of one of Napoleon's brothers, Letitia Bonaparte, she was called. She was a sort of a slightly louche figure who had affairs with various people, but he had an affair with her for a while. And there were lots and lots of puns about them and things he'd said to her and she'd supposed to said to him. And there was one I remember where she said to a friend, some are born great, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them, with the idea that, you know, her lover, this great big bulk of a man, was sort of collapsing on top of her in bed or something. And these jokes were relayed, you know, from one paper to another, because newspapers printed stuff straight from other newspapers without attribution. People just love to laugh at him.
Sorry, I've got this image in my head now.
Sorry, yes.
Moving on to a much nicer
image. I apologise for that, yeah.
No, that's my fault. I never grew up past 17. But moving on to a nicer image. Could an artist really do the beauty of Lady Charlotte Newry justice?
Well, apparently not, to judge from what people said. I mean, the two most esteemed portrait painters, John Hoppner and Thomas Lawrence, both tried to paint pictures of her, and both of the pictures were considered to be failures, and quite bad failures. And Lawrence actually studied Lady Charlotte Berry at parties and tried to capture the way that her eyes were upturned sometimes and tried to capture the way she moved. And he failed in his attempt to paint her, and other people painted her and nobody could do it. And people said that she was so beautiful that art actually couldn't capture her beauty. Which people theorized about. People said that she was so beautiful because she was the incarnation of nature. People said that she was the incarnation of the classical ideal of beauty, and that her beauty was born of some kind of harmony of mind and body. People sort of said these extremely enthusiastic things about her. And it just became an understood thing that it was impossible to put this on canvas.
So did anyone actually manage to do her any kind of justice, or was it all just complete write-off? Do we actually know how beautiful she was supposedly was?
Well, there aren't that many. The curious thing is, although she was considered the most beautiful woman of her generation, and lots of people said that, there aren't many physical descriptions of her. She wasn't a fragile-looking woman. She was tall, and she was quite physically strong. She had a sort of rose and cream complexion. She moved very beautifully. Apparently she walked well. She had golden hair. She probably wasn't somebody who was in accord with modern ideas of beauty. It was an ideal of beauty more of that time in various ways. But she was strong. She was quite athletic, and she looked healthy. And that was the nature of her beauty. And then, you know, this idea of her being a beauty like from classical antiquity, people comparing her with Roman vases and wall paintings and Herculaneum and things like this, that fell together with a new fashion for Roman style dress for women, the so-called empire line of dress, where women wear these very thin gauze-like dresses, which are tied just below the bust, so there's no waistline, and then they fall freely to the ground. That was the style that just came in the 1790s. And because she was considered to be a classical beauty, and this classical style of dress came in, which she became a leading part of, you know, some people even said she introduced it. Everything seemed to fall together. Everything was natural and perfect.
Moving on to Thomas Lawrence. Now, it's probably not a name that people immediately recognise, but you will have seen one of his paintings at some point when I was doing the research and I looked through. I was like, oh, he painted that one of Wellington. He had quite an obscure origins, but how did he overcome those to become the pictorial chronicler of the Regency?
He overcame his obscure origins by being a child prodigy, really. His father was an innkeeper at Devizes in Wiltshire and had quite a few children. But it became obvious by the time that Thomas Lawrence was about five that he was an infant prodigy. He could recite verses from memory, Milton and Shakespeare especially, and he could draw people's faces, which he was completely self-taught in that. He just something he started doing. And so when guests came to stay in this inn, and people, as they travelled across the country, they'd stay in inns in every town, including quite famous people, Lawrence's father would produce this little boy, either to read, either to declaim poetry, or to draw a likeness of the guests. And he was such a beautiful child, and he had such natural grace, or, you know, that's what the report says. And he was so clever, and he was so engaging, that everybody wanted to do things for him. He was one of these people that everybody wants to do things for. One woman wanted to adopt him. The sister of the Earl of Warwick wanted to adopt him. Somebody else wanted to take him to London to show him around the art galleries. Another person offered to have him sent to Italy to learn to become an artist there. Somebody else gave him gifts. Everybody wanted to do things for him. And everybody wanted to claim that they'd had a part in discovering him. There's this whole narrative of discovery that was going on. And then his father, who was a bit of a showman, a bit of an impresario by nature, and didn't want to work himself, after twice failing as an innkeeper, he just sort of threw in the towel and stopped working. He instead became his son's promoter, and he took him to Bath and put adverts in the papers, and all the high society people like Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire, and others wanted to have their faces sketched by him. It became a sort of fashionable thing to do, and it just went on from there. Everybody, while he was a teenager as well, everybody wanting to help him, everybody wanting to push him forward, and then the move to London, obviously becoming established as an artist, and he wore his origins very lightly. He never denied his origins. He wasn't obsequious, but he had a sort of natural charm, a lot of self possession. He was a good listener. He was quite kind, and he just got on with the people he was with. He had a very agreeable, attractive manner, and he was a good-looking man as well. So everything was in his favour.
He does kind of the opposite to Harriet, Duchess of St. Albans, in that whereas she openly spoke about her background, he acknowledges it but just doesn't talk about it.
Yes, he's very at ease with himself. And sometimes people are amazed when they learn what his origins are, because everybody assumes that he's a gentleman by birth, which is supposed to be this innate thing that people, you know, had or didn't have. But he was so elegant, so refined, so urbane. Also, as I say, not pushing himself forward too much. He was quite reticent. He let other people do the talking. He didn't tell a lot of jokes or anything. It just made him somebody that people wanted to be with. Yeah. And obviously, that'd be combined with his great talent and his growing reputation as an artist, which made him more and more established in society. And everybody wanted their portrait painted by him.
So I know I've mentioned Wellington already, and I know this is audio, so you can't see it, but the very famous painting of Wellington in his military red coat is that one. But who else? What other sort of major figures were painted by him?
Well, he painted all sorts of people whose names are forgotten now, but he also painted very famous people like Sarah Siddons, the actress. But he painted all the senior politicians and foreign heads of state, including the Pope and the Pope's most important cardinal, royalty in Austria. He went on a European tour from 1818 to 1820, sort of commissioned by George the Fourth, or the regent as he still was then, and produced what's now called the Waterloo Gallery in Windsor Castle. All these pictures of people who were involved in the alliance against Napoleon, more or less directly. So he is the sort of visual chronicler of his age, and he was a fairly flattering artist, but without being too flattering in most cases. And and as I say, he charged the highest prices, which added to his allure as well. And he was the number one portraitist, and he painted all the leading European figures of the day.
Charging the most probably made his father quite happy.
Yes, well, he supported his parents, and in fact, he supported his siblings. I mean, his brothers and sisters never seemed to have quite enough money, And I also had lots of children. He never married, but he had siblings that he supported. He supported his parents. You know, he completely funded their household. He loved his family very much. He never had anything but praise and love for his own family. And he was the breadwinner for all of them. He also gave a lot of money away. He was thought to be a bit of a gambler as well, which got through a certain amount of money. But no, he was very generous to his family.
If my daughter's listening to this, when you become rich and famous, Daddy's bank is always open. So I know you have to draw the line somewhere when you're writing these sort of books. But what made you choose these specific portraits and early celebrities?
Well, I suppose it was partly that they were people I'd come across when I was involved with earlier projects, people who'd caught my eye. I wanted to have a range of people. I wanted to have men and women. I've got three women and two men. I wanted to have people from different walks of life. So you've got the theatre, you've got the London party scene, you've got diplomacy, you've got parliamentary politics, you've got the world of literature, you've got the world of fashion, clothes and fashion with Lady Charlotte Berry, who was a leader of fashion. You've got the world of art, obviously, with Thomas Lawrence. So you've got all these different spheres of life, which I also go into a bit. And I try and show that although all these spheres are different, the mechanisms of celebrity, including things like celebrity endorsements and press coverage and what have you, you know, work in the same way across all of them.
Absolutely. And it does flow very well together. It was really quite an interesting read. But is there anyone that you thought, now, once it had all gone off to the publishers, and thought, oh, bugger, maybe I should have put them in as well?
Yeah, I mean, there are other people. In fact, I've already made a list of another five or six people. Well, six it is. There are five in this book, but I've made a list of another group of people that I'd quite like to look at more. I mean, the thing is that it's so easy now to read newspapers. That's what made this book possible. With digital archives of newspapers, I use the British Newspaper Archive. You can find information so easily because you can do word searches. Although they're scans, you can word search them. So you can really write a new kind of biography in a way, which is a biography of somebody's public image. You know, a lot of biographies obviously concentrate on people's private lives and are based on letters and, you know, personal statements and memoirs and things like this. And there's quite a lot of that in my book as well. But because of these newspaper archives and the way that you can just track somebody's image and track how they were talked about, you can look at people in a new way. And you could do this with lots of people. I think the availability of newspaper archives online is you know, something that's very exciting. It's certainly exciting to me.
Absolutely. So I do First World War stuff, naval stuff, and it's quite helpful for that as well, getting people's opinions on things. So yeah, and I think especially during COVID, where everything has sort of become more digitized, it's making the researcher's job a lot more interesting and
yes.
easy.
Yes. Well, it made a big difference, especially with lockdown, because I couldn't go to archives. I couldn't travel about as much as I wanted to do, especially towards the end when I was writing about Thomas Lawrence. So I relied on archives sending me things. But yes, the fact that I could just sit here where I'm sitting now and just look at all these old newspapers on the screen in front of me and listen and read all these puns, all these little anecdotes that were put in the papers about people, it was a real luxury.
Absolutely. And as you said, it does give you a much more rounded image of the people that you're writing about, especially with, like we were saying, with celebrity, you have the actual person and then the image that they're portraying.
Yes. And you can really see the tensions between the two sometimes. I mean, as well as these five portraits, my book has a long section about how celebrity culture works, how it was born, and then there's a bit on the poets and a bit on actors and actresses. And I know we touched on that, but that's all separate from the five set piece biographies. And It was very interesting to see how the workings of celebrity culture were replicated across all those areas.
Yeah, absolutely. I found it a very riveting read.
Thank you.
If you wouldn't mind reminding everyone what the title is and where they can buy it.
Well, the title is The First Celebrities, Five Regency Portraits. It's going to be published on the 15th of January, and it'll be available in bookshops, obviously on the Waterstones website and Amazon. And
I will I'll have a word with our powers that be. We have a History Hack online bookshop, so everyone the money goes to the people who deserve it.
Well, that sounds perfect. Yes, that sounds very attractive.
Absolutely. Then hopefully one day I can retire on my daughter's money.
Yeah.
But Peter, this has been really interesting. Thank you ever so much for coming on to talk to us about Georgian portraiture and biography.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a really enjoyable talk for me as well. Thank you.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.